You are listening to Absent Minded, brought to you by HabsEyesOnThePrize.com.
Hello and welcome to Absent Minded. We got a couple of episodes in regards to top 25, under 25, and for once, we're the full continent here today. Matt, thank you for joining us in the middle of a workday.
In the middle of a workday. So, like, don't tell my boss. I got a question for you guys, though, before we get started. Are you guys NFL fans?
Yeah.
What's your favorite teams?
It used to be the Cleveland Browns.
The Cleveland Browns. Okay. Yeah. What about you, Jared?
Tennessee Titans.
Zero Super Bowls. What about you, Pat?
Well, I'm an old guy, so, you know, it's the Packers for me.
The Packers. All right. Well, myself, I'm a big fan of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the two-time Super Bowl champion Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And if you happen to be a fan of an NFL team as well, we got some really good news for you. Fans First Sports Network is giving away 4 free tickets to the week 1 NFL game of your choice, up to $5,000. Rules to enter are pretty simple. All you got to do is go over to contest.fansfirstsports.com. That's contest.fansfirstsports.com. Fill out the appropriate information and that's it. Once you've done that, you're entered to register and win 4 free tickets to any week 1 NFL game. What are you waiting for? Go over pretty quick because the contest ends on September 4th. So hurry up. You might want to go see the Cleveland Browns or the Super Bowl-less Tennessee Titans if you're Jared. I don't know. Do whatever you like.
Hey, I mean, if there's 4 tickets, does it cover the airfare from Sweden as well?
Yeah, well, with $5,000, I think it would, Manton, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I mean, for this season, I will be a Buccaneers fan because I'm a fan of Baker Mayfield and he's the starting QB for the Bucs now. So,
but the thing is, though, there's like this crazy storm going into Florida, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's yes, called Baker Mayfield.
Yeah, it's Hurricane Baker is coming to take on the NFL. All right.
Well, we love the fact that NFL is about to start. I hope you enjoy your fantasy leagues and getting warmed up for the fantasy leagues in hockey. And we're here to talk about the plateaus. And I'm not talking about the Highland Plateau of Inner China or the Central African one, or not even the Colombian wine in South America. We're talking about plateaus in the top 25, under 25 rankings. And there's been quite a few of them, Jared. It's never really been this crazy with plateaus before. It's been more of a ladder and this time it's more of like, here's a group of players and then there's a big jump.
Yeah. I feel like the whole ranking is here's a bunch of players and try and figure them out. And before you know it, you know, players you really like are in the 30s. And I'm like, oh, how did that happen? The numbers this year, I think matter less than any other year. It reminds me of like the days when like Charles Houdon was like top 5 and people look back and like, oh, how could you have Charles Houdon in number 5? It's like, well, look who else is there. It's not our fault. The Canadians had no depth under 25 years old. And I feel like this year is the opposite. It's like, how could you have this guy so low? And it's like, well, look at the guys ahead. How are we supposed to move them up? And that's what you see here. And because of that, there's little groupings of similar ranked prospects, prospects who are, you know, in the same range of life. And I think that it makes for interesting discussions because, you know, you can argue a guy is 5 spots higher or lower than he should be, but really it's like less than half a point between him and the person 5 spots below.
Yeah, and Anton, if we look at the rankings, first and foremost, what stands out is really that Elias Andersson made the rankings at number 27, but he was ranked number 25. Elias Andersson made the ranking at 25, but he was ranked 27th in the combined rankings. But below him, we have the first real grouping, which is 6 players within 1.6 of the consolidated rankings. And I mean, there are some high quality prospects there, and there are some obviously trending down for one reason or another. Are you surprised about that grouping?
In retrospect, I'm I really like some players like Vincent Rohrer and Oliver Kapanen, also William Trudeau, and Xavier Simonot. That's the problem. Like, there are too many players now that you actually feel quite good about, that you feel like if you have a 10 grade scale of prospects, then you at least feel high enough to maybe rank, you know, them in as having a decent chance of becoming NHL players, at least for some part of their career. If we look like 3-4 years back, a lot of these players would have been in the high teens on a top 25 under 25 ranking, and now it's basically like Caden Primo and Matthias Norlander, who were top 5, top 10 players just a couple of years ago. Now they are down there in that position, together with four players who are trending upwards. So yeah, it's really interesting. And obviously, Elias Andersson was an AHL quality player, and he's going to be there as a veteran presence for the Laval Rocket this season. So it's not bad that he is at the number 25. It's probably fair value considering that he has actually proved more, especially at the AHL level, than a lot of these other players. But yeah, I can definitely see Kapanen, Trudeau, Rohrer, Simonov moving upwards in the upcoming years.
Matt, obviously, you know, there are more. I mean, it's almost the same amount of plateaus. There is gaps between the plateaus. We got Elias Andersson as a gap, but then you got the two goalies, Fowler and Dobich, more or less on tight.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've seen it with goalies before, that they have a tendency to start out pretty low on our list and then rocket their way up, you know, as their careers go on. I was kind of surprised to see Fowler land that high as a recent draftee. I thought he might have been a little bit lower on the list. Dobish surprises me a little bit less. I think he's come on through his NCAA career in the eyes of Habs fans, and I think people are kind of looking forward to see what he can do in the AHL this year. I figured, you know, Fowler was going to be lower on that list, because usually they just have to, like, that's kind of the thing with goalies, is they got to start a little bit lower. We've got a high standard in Montreal, thanks to having, you know, Carey Price for so long, that some of these goalies can't start that high. So I was kind of surprised that he actually made it into the list. But like you said, you got that grouping below them, just underneath Elias Andersson, that didn't make the top 25. Some of those guys had, like, a number of them had votes inside the top 25. Anton touched on Xavier Simonot. He had three guys, including Anton, myself, and Hattie, that all ranked him inside of our top 25. I had him at 21, Hattie had him at 17, and Anton had him at 23. People seem to forget this is a guy that scored almost 40 points with Laval last season. Like, that's how good this list was. Even when you go deep to the people who just barely missed it, you've got some legitimate prospects that have potential, you know, legitimate shots at making the NHL as early as the next couple of years.
Indeed. And if you look at the plateau just above Jaden Struble, who's in the middle of his own a little bit, but then you got Heinemann, Ilonen, Kidney, Meshar, and let's be honest here. Heinemann, Ilonen, and Kidney are more or less fighting about the same spot on the main roster.
Pretty much, right? And I think Heinemann, he might have the inside track at this point. I don't know. I mean, he was really good at camp last year. I think he turned a lot of heads. And if they are fighting for the same roster spot, he could hypothetically have the inside track, which sounds weird because Ilonen has actually been in North America. He's been playing with Laval, clearly very good on the power plays, an area where the Montreal Canadiens definitely could use a little bit of help. But it should be interesting to see what those guys do at camp. And, you know, they're ranked right beside each other. And you mentioned the plateaus, right? I mean, he's literally, Heinemann, if I'm looking at the list right now, was 0.333 higher in the consolidated rankings. So basically, when you take the rankings together, they were ranked, they're basically tied.
Yeah, more or less they are. And one thing that speaks maybe to Heinemann's disadvantage is that he doesn't need waivers to go down. And this might be something that impacts very good players, Jared.
Yeah, I think that's something that they're going to have to look at. I mean, even when you go, you know, higher up the rankings, there's a lot of talented players that don't need waivers that they might send down instead of losing somebody on waivers or putting somebody on waivers. It's going to be very interesting, because especially after the Mike Hoffman, Rem Pitlick trade, there's a little bit more room to play with at forward. And I think that there are opportunities for players who perform well in camp. The defense is going to be a little bit of a mess, I think, just because I think that there's, you know, even if you just take the players who were in the NHL last year, There's eight players for a handful of spots, and we're going to get to some, I guess, in the next grouping of players. But yeah, for me, everything from my list, I think about 23, 24 up, was very close. But between like 9, 10, and 23 was extremely close. And so there were obviously little tiers in there, but it's such a, you mentioned before about guys who were in the 30s, or Anton did, who would be in the teens. I think that a lot of the players, you know, from 20, 24, 25, up to 15 would have been top 10 in other years, potentially. So yeah, it's a really good group of prospects. And the hard part for us, and people who do the rankings, is that it's a very young ranking, right? Everyone is in their first or second year professionally in North America, or just entering their first year. Like, there's not a lot of like-to-like comparisons to go by. And so I think that that's something that makes it more challenging. And really what makes these groupings closer together is that, you know, who's to say whether Emil Heinemann or Riley Kidney is better, because they've been playing on different sides of the world, in different leagues, and it's incredibly hard to compare them. Same thing with Philip Machar. So I think this year, with a lot of them going to be in Laval, it's going to make it a little bit more clear probably next year. But I think that's one of the big challenges this year and why everything is so close.
Well, put it this way too, like, Kidney has back-to-back 100-point seasons in the queue. If we go back, if we rewind the clock even 2 years backwards right now, if we had a guy who had two back-to-back 100-point seasons, he's top five, without a doubt.
I was going to say,
And he doesn't have a single top five vote. And matter of fact, looking at the list, he doesn't have a single top 10 vote, Riley Kidney.
I was
highest. His highest ranking was Anton at 15. Yeah. And
Riley Kidney might be the most underrated, like, 100-point scorer the Canadians have had in the organization.
Back-to-back.
It surprises me when you even say that he has 100 points, because it's like, it doesn't compute, because like, he's so, I don't want to say he's so far down the list, but because he's so like out of mind, I think, compared to everybody else, that's just kind of like, oh yeah, that guy's really good too. Like, I think he gets lost a little bit more than Owen Beck does, as an example, right? And there's like, 10 spots between the two almost. So I mean, yeah, it's very interesting to see, like, perception is so much. Like, if Riley Kidney played in the preseason game last year, you know, you can probably move him up like 10 spots because he gets more eyes on him, right? So
it's also
interesting.
Yeah, it's also easier maybe to see a route into the NHL for Owen Beck. He doesn't have to be that big point total guy, but Riley Kidney maybe has to, you know, be on a top six line and, you know, have the correct line mates to be able to provide those, you know, those dangles and all the technical plays that he can do. But it's also, I was going to say the same about Emil Heinemann. Like, this guy comes over and he has 7 goals and 2 assists in his first 11 games with the Rocket, and is outside of the top 20. And this guy is what?
Well, he has a shooting percentage of what, 22%?
But it doesn't matter. If we compare to a couple of years ago, this guy's 21 years old. If we saw someone come in and just produce that way in his first few games at North American level, we would be over the moon. And now it's just like, all right, maybe you will be turned into something, but it doesn't really matter because we have a lot of other guys that we hope more for.
But isn't this also part of the fan base being maybe a little bit more educated in regards to, you know, shooting percentage and overall play?
No.
Yeah, no. But at the same time, it's maybe the depth a little of bit, the group.
I think that's the main thing, right? Because, and Anton kind of touched on it a little bit too, is that before, and if you look at past rankings, it was like, oh man, Charles Hudon, he's tearing up the AHL. He has to work. And if he doesn't, there's nobody else there. And in this prospect pool, it's like, okay, so, you know, they have Slavkovsky, they have, you know, Joshua Hua, they have, you know, guys like that. But if they don't work, then they have the intriguing guys like the Heinemanns, the Ullinens, the Kidneys and stuff like that. And I think that what we used to be the top tier of prospect in Montreal, where you're hoping for guys where you might not see a clear path, or there's some issues in their game, and you just bet on the upside. now there's so many more, you know, I don't want to say sure things, but more well-rounded prospects, that those guys who have the high toolkits and are like, oh, I don't know if they can make it to the next level, they kind of drop down a little bit, because you have guys who have done it before, or you know, in the case of Harvey Pinard and guys like that. And you know, I'm kind of moving ahead of myself a little bit, but Sean Farrell, right? Like, he would have been top five in previous years. Like, you have a scorer like that, one of the top scorers in the NCAA, goes to the Olympics, goes to the World Championships, and you know, barely makes what, the top 15.
Well, you have the same with the two with the defensive pairing, more or less, yeah. And at 15.6 and 15.7 with Cheka and Mayo. We touched on it. The defense will be a crapshoot, really, in or a shootout at Oco Corral, who's left standing at the end of it. Matt, is there a risk that Cheka actually gets sent down to the Rocket because he doesn't need waivers? Or does he? He doesn't, right?
No, he doesn't.
Look, he doesn't need waivers, so there's definitely a risk that happens. I think it depends how things shake out in camp. I think he does bring an element. This has been brought up. I can't take credit for this. I've seen multiple people say this on Twitter and elsewhere. Almost every team in the division has added some face punchers in the offseason. The Leafs have Ryan Reeves now. I think that element that Jack Eye brings of being willing to drop the gloves and being capable of going with some of the heavyweights in the league, I think they're going to need that at some point. So he's going to be playing for the Habs, but I do think there's a strong possibility that he plays some games for Laval as well, because the simple fact is this team is still working through the rebuild. They need to figure out who can play in their top four moving forward. And if they don't have those players right now, then they need to go out and look for them towards the end of the rebuild. So they need to try some guys out. And unfortunately, I think that might come at the expense of Jack Eye, because we know pretty well at this point what he can and can't do. And they need to figure out what other people can and can't do. So if he's not requiring waivers, anybody not requiring waivers is going to be at the risk of playing some games in Laval for sure.
Anton, is it terrible to lose Chris Weidman on a free, more or less?
No. Why would it be terrible? No. Like, Chris Weidman was a lovely guy, and I was happy that he got, you know, a proper chance in the NHL after tearing up the KHL. But he's a guy for a subpar NHL team who doesn't have a power play quarterback for the second power play. And this team has at least a couple of guys coming up now in the upcoming years who can fill that role. And it's fun to see. We're going to get to Justin Barron in a while. And we've already touched on William Trudeau, for example, who took Barron's place on the power play in Laval when Barron got sent up. So there are a couple of guys, except for obviously Mayu and Hudson and these guys, who can, you know, add some offense from the defensive spot. So yeah, Chris Weidman as a personality, great. Otherwise, he will not be missed on the ice. I was just going to say, like, it would be fun to just for a couple of games during the season, see Logan Mayu and Arber Cheka on the same pairing in Laval, and just see what kind of like dynamic they would have together, because it would be imposing at least.
I'm glad you added Laval, because I thought you were going with the NHL.
No, God, no.
I'm like, I don't know if I want to see that in the NHL this season.
No.
Let's face Toronto with that pairing and see what happens, eh?
We'll see what happens there, but yeah, I think that you know, in Chris Weidman's case, at least he doesn't have to take an Uber from Montreal to Laval. There's a metro.
Looking at one of the groupings that really stood out and resulted in a lot of discussion was the Sean Farrell, Jordan Harris, Harvey Pinard, Engström, and Barron. And a lot of people were saying he should be ranked higher, he should be ranked higher, or this one should be ranked higher, and this one is too high, et cetera, et cetera. But essentially, they are tied for 11th. Or for what? Yeah, 11th.
Yeah, I think that's a group that's so interesting to me. And I think why they're grouped together is because you have some people who, you know, are low on them, and some people who are much higher on them in some cases, right? I mean, the ranges on those in that group of players, I mean, Barron goes 10 to 21. Engstrom goes 7-18. Harvey Pinard goes 10-16. Harris goes 9-20. Farrell goes 8-31. Like the ranges are so wide that once you get to the averages, they are all kind of the same, but people have wildly different thoughts about them. Like if you ranked, you know, Sean Farrell 31st and you know, Adam Engstrom 7th as an example, like you're going to say, how could these players be so close together? But then when you average it all out, it all kind of makes sense.
And Matt, it's been 500 votes. So the Eyes on the Prize community has really stepped up and give some really, really strong feedback into the system, right?
Yeah, I think the community vote's important. I can't remember how long ago did we institute that, where we made it one of the panel votes. I want to say this was back in like 2016 or 2015. It was a while ago, but you can see it really adds to the panel. I think having more votes is why, as you mentioned, as Jared said, you know, some people might have on their personal ballots, they go, well, I don't get it. I had this guy ranked in the 40s or whatever, but how did he get that high? It's because there's a lot of those variances, and some of those lower rankings are what drag them down a little bit. I think, you know, you look at Justin Barron, Docmatic, one of our community voters that got brought in and put as part of the panel, had him at 21. You know, you have him a little bit higher. He might get a little bit closer to Owen Beck. He might be in that next plateau up there with Beck and Josh Marois. So, you know, it's always good to have more votes. I think that's what makes the exercise fun, is that we've got so much input that goes into it. It can really, it more accurately represents the fan base.
I mean, I'm glad you brought up Joshua Roy, because if someone didn't rank him at number one, you know, he would have been in the same grouping as Barron and Engstrom and Pinard, Harris and Farrell.
Well, I'm glad I did, because I'm out there fighting the good fight. All right.
Well, as mentioned, Beck, Roy and Newhook, and I dare I say that Newhook might be undervalued here, Jared.
Yeah, I think with Newhook, it's kind of weird, because for me, in my ranking, he was clearly 8th. like he was, there's like, you want to talk about like plateaus in my rankings, like Alex Newhook was by himself, because he was.
Oh,
he was
so you got that one right as well.
I did get that one right. and really what's interesting with me is I think the guys above Newhook all had really high votes, right? Like, you know, from Hudson, Slavkovsky, Gouley, all the way down to Waugh, they all had votes in the top five, whereas Newhook's only, you know, 7th. And I think that that's what makes it so interesting. And I think that, you know, Newhook had a high of 7, a low of 12. Like, it was very, very clear where people thought of him. He was kind of like in between the grouping below and the grouping above. And I think that when you have the averages, it kind of makes a bigger gap than appears to be the case, because I don't think the gap between Newhook and Rheinbacher is that big as it is in the rankings. I mean, it's almost 3 spots in terms of points on the rankings. But I think what was clear is that Rheinbacher was probably ahead of Newhook. So when everyone votes ahead, for the most part, it makes it that it creates that gap but for me, I mean, Newhook was clearly 8th, with a chance to move up, just like Kirby Dock was 5th a year ago and had a chance to move up, and he did.
I have to answer to that, because I was the only one who put Newhook ahead of Rheinbacher, and it's just no, but it's just interesting, because leading up to the draft, obviously David Rheinbacher kept rising. Everyone kept saying like, oh, he's going to be picked earlier. Basically the same as when Caden Gouley got selected 16th by the Canadiens in 2020. Basically what Montreal were saying was that if we hadn't won that series, that play-in series over Pittsburgh, we would still have wanted him at 9. They said that they got their guy, basically. And it felt the same here. Like, they wanted Rheinbacher and they picked him at 5th. And it's the same way that the Red Wings selected Moritz Seider. But like a couple of years ago, a few years ago now, 4 years ago, Alex Newhook was selected 16th overall. And he could have been selected earlier as well. He has played a lot of NHL games, and you know, even if he didn't come to his full fruition there, we have seen the same thing happen with Kirby Dach, and we've seen Martin Saint-Louis being excellent in developing younger players and making them find a bigger role and bigger confidence in his system. So at this point, Alex Newhook is an NHL player, and we still don't know what David Reinbacher is. We know that he was excellent in the Swiss league, but for me, it was clear to put Newhook ahead of Reinbacher, and I was surprised to see Newhook being below our recent fifth overall pick, actually.
I will have to say, though, that I know a lot of comments, they say this, I read the comments every day on the articles and every morning if I'm not driving, because then I have to drive. But essentially, a lot of people say if a team gives up on a player, you rank them lower. And I think that might be Newhook's fault in this case. Not fault, but it's a disadvantage for Newhook in that case. On the other hand, Emil Heinemann has been traded twice already, and he's on a steady climb. Matt, we got Caden Gooley, Lane Hudson, and David Reinbacher in that plateau on the top five, or could have been top five, all of them. Is that the core of the new defense coming up?
I think so. I think that's the hope. I mean, we saw Lane Hudson and David Reinbacher together at development camp, and they had immediate chemistry. I think that's a pairing that the team wants to take their time with, and I think they want those guys to come up together into the NHL. And I could see that working at the next level as well. It just looked so good at development camp. You don't want to read too much into, you know, scrimmages and stuff like that at a dev camp, but just the smoothness, the familiarity that they seem to have with each other so quickly, that kind of thing could play in the future, and it could be a pairing for a long time for the Habs. And Caden Gooley, I think everybody's looked at him as, you know, the future number one on the left side at some point. Right now I have him behind Mike Matheson, and I wrote this in the article for him on the top 25 under 25. I think for Caden Gooley, the key this year is figuring out the right partner. Clearly last year it did not work with David Savard. It worked a little bit better with Joel Edmondson, but it was not a fun role for Caden Gooley to be in. I don't think he was ready for that number one left D role, and that's what he was forced to play. He had the highest quality of competition of anybody on the roster throughout the course of the season. And I think, and again, this is me spitballing here and playing armchair doctor, I think it played into his injury woes. I think he had to play way more minutes than he was ready to play at the top level in the NHL on a struggling team. So he was playing against the best that the opposition had to offer on a night in, night out basis. I absolutely think that getting him in the right role in that second pair with the right partner, either Justin Barron or Johnny Kovacevic, would be my pick to play with him this year. And I think you'll see a lot better out of him. As for the other two, like I said, their chemistry already at dev camp looked fantastic. When those three are, you know, at their full development peak, I think absolutely you're looking at the top three defensemen on the Montreal Canadiens.
Jared, you were there. You watched Hudson and Reinbacher in development camp. But I'm going to put you on the spot here. We could see a future first pairing in dev camp and in rookie camp and main camp, because we could see Caden Gooley and David Reinbacher together.
Yeah, I don't think Caden Gooley is going to be at rookie camp. I think he's earned the little break before that. But in training camp, yeah, I think you can definitely see those two together. Maybe not this year. I think they might want to insulate them a little bit, maybe in practice, things like that. But yeah, I think that, you know, it's really interesting, because I see those guys were essentially tied in my rankings. Like I had Reinbacher 4, Hudson 5, Gooley 6. But in my mind, it was just like, you know, ask if I didn't tell me that order, I might not remember it and put them in a different order the next time. So, yeah, I think that it's going to be really interesting to see these guys develop, because, you know, those are like cornerstones on defense. You know, if in 5 years they have Reinbacher, Gooley, Hudson, and they all become, you know, top four defenders, the Canadians are in really good shape.
Yeah.
The key is figuring out who's the other top four. I think those three are bound for the top four at some point. Like if their development goes as we expect it to go, I think all three of them will be in the top four. It's who's the other guy, right? Is it Justin Barron?
Who's the Brett Kulak to the Trident?
I wanted to ask about that very thing, because there is one guy that we're forgetting who got acquired after we had already submitted the votes and started with all this. There's a guy called Gustav Lindström who was acquired from the Red Wings,
who couldn't even make Frölunda's roster in the Swedish finals.
All right, but that was a couple of years ago, and now he's played 125 NHL games. So my question is, if he had been acquired a month before and he had been available for rankings here, where would everyone had put him on the top 25?
Late 20s.
Yeah,
because for me, he would have been in that like Norlander, a little bit below, like probably that the Beaudin tier, I would say.
Because he's obviously a dark horse, you know, just being a right-handed defenseman on a porous defensive line, he's still a candidate to start the season in the NHL. And we saw Jonathan Kovacevic come in last season without having made much of a name for himself in Winnipeg, for example, and blossom into a full-time NHL defenseman with the Habs. And as you mentioned, Brett Kulak has done the same. So who knows?
I think we'll see it in next year's rankings. I think we're all going to have to make some adjustments based on what we see this year.
Yep.
And we might see that group get even tighter in that plateau next go around. Again, it's who else can really sneak into that top four conversation that's currently young. Is it Justin Barron? Is it Logan Mailloux? Right? Logan Mailloux is probably going to get his first taste of professional hockey this year. If he does really well in Laval, there's a chance that he ends up getting a chance to skate with Caden Gooley at some point.
But it's also the fact that you look at players like Mailloux, players like Engström, that has a lot to prove in this upcoming season in different leagues. But, you know, a bad year for either of them will drop them off quite a bit.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Look at Philip Machar. That's a perfect example. He didn't even have a bad season. He was point per game in the OHL. But expectations were so high that point per game just wasn't good enough. And he slid like, what, 8 spots?
Sean Farrell as well. Year. Sean Farrell, just because he came into the NHL and wasn't ready.
Yeah, if Sean Farrell didn't play NHL games, I think he'd be top 10.
Yeah, exactly.
because he played NHL games, it's like, oh, he's not good enough for the NHL.
Yeah.
It's very interesting because, yeah, you have that dynamic where guys with good seasons go up. But you have the dynamic where with poor seasons, they go down. And, you know, Norlander is an example of that too, right? Because he hasn't really been bad. He just hasn't been putting up great numbers and you know, been dropping in the rankings because of that. Then, you know, a guy like William Trudeau, you know, he didn't have, you know, great numbers. Like his points weren't great, but he was clearly the number one defenseman on that team for most of the year. If he does that again, then you know we might be talking about him in the NHL this year.
I want to make the comparison between Jordan Harris, William Trudeau, and Jordan Harris. That they're just like they're not making a name for themselves by being the biggest or the fastest or the having the heaviest shot or something like that, having the greatest angles. So basically, you don't really think about them. Like even now, when we talk about future top four defensemen for the Montreal Canadiens, we keep forgetting Jordan Harris. Like he could still develop into a top four defenseman. He has shown that he is a steady NHL defenseman. He can still develop into something more.
He had really good analytics last year. Exactly. In his NHL minutes. Like it was not. And again, all of this is within the context of the Habs being absolutely horrible last year. So if you manage to have good analytics on a really bad team, you know, you're doing something right and you're 100% correct. Like I think I forgot to even mention him when I was talking about possible top fours. Jordan Harris could sneak his way into that conversation. And that's why I said, I think next year, we might see a lot of movement among the defensemen, depending on what happens this year. And I think a lot of that is going to play into who gets the chance to come up and play in the NHL. Like Jared said, what if William Trudeau gets a chance to come up to the NHL and he looks fantastic and he gets a 20 game stint and he looks great towards the end of the year? What happens? I mean, nobody's going to be able to really justify leaving him in the late 20s or the 30s at that point. Everybody's going to have to bump him up. What if the same thing happens with Jordan Harris? What if there's a few injuries and Jordan Harris ends up playing a bunch of the year in the top four and he looks fantastic? Everybody's going to have to bump him up. He's not going to be in the teens anymore. He's going to be jumping into that top 10. There could be a lot of movement.
Jordan Harris to me is kind of like Riley Kidney at forward, because he doesn't do anything spectacular, right? He doesn't have like that one skill where you can be like, oh, that's great. Like Logan Mayu has a shot. Keaton Gooley has like the gap control and stuff like that. Jordan Harris, he doesn't do anything like outstanding. And I think the same thing with Riley Kidney. He doesn't have anything that's outstanding, but the group of everything together makes a really productive player. And I think that that's why, you know, guys like Harris are seen as below guys like Mayu or Jack Eye, because, you know, both of those guys have skills that they you watch them on the ice, and between the size and the skating and the physicality, they have something that makes you notice them. Whereas guys like Harris and Trudeau, they don't really do anything that's noticeable, but they're just always in the right place and shutting down plays. And, you know, it's kind of like a referee or an umpire in baseball, where like, if you don't notice them screwing up, it's a good thing. Right. And I think like that's kind of what they do, is because they don't really do those highlight reel plays. It's just,
solid. I think you just spoke about minutes. Every goalie in the world in every sport.
Yeah.
No, but
absolutely. Absolutely. It's very similar.
Yeah, it's the same also. Well, like when everyone spoke about Barcelona during Pep Guardiola being the best team ever and everything. And like one, no one understood at the time, basically, was that Sergio Busquets, who was the defensive midfielder of that team, he was the one making everything tick. But no one saw him apart from when he was complaining to the referee. So like no one thought of him as being like this, you know, phenomenal player, because he was just in the right position all the time, 90 minutes. And that was basically it. If you have that kind of like patrolling player, regardless of the sport, who's just like, he's there, he does his job, and he does exactly what the coach wants him to do, he becomes like, you know, just invaluable. I mean, it's great to see these like heavy hits and, you know, hard shots and everything, but like that, their highlight reel plays, you want someone who's also steady for 60 minutes of a hockey game.
You want someone that gives that guy the opportunity to use his fantastic skill or special skill at any given point. We have been speaking for far too long, and it's not only Jared that is speaking far too long today. We all have. So congrats.
I was good today. I was good.
See, I was saying that. You were good. It's a spray ribbon soin that has been taking up much of the space here on the Zoom channel. We are looking forward to hear your thoughts on in a future article. We want to hear your thoughts on this top 25 under 25, the podcast version. We're going to continue in to December with a lot more coverage on the podcast and of course in written form on Ice on the Prize. Thank you all three for joining me, and we'll be back shortly with more podcasts and more articles.
Mischief is back and better than ever.
Loki.
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 Wow. Great to see you again.
Critics agree. Loki season 2 is
marvelous.
Great. And it's finally here.
How much do you know?
Let's assume I don't know much.
A mind-bending adventure. Spectacularly cinematic.
I've been waiting for a moment like this.
It surpasses all expectations.
A little over the top, don't you think?
I thought it was spot on.
Loki season 2. Now streaming only on Disney+.